and welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name's Rustin, and I'm here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Aaron.
Every couple of weeks, as you guys know, Aaron and I'll get together to talk about some particular theme within the wild and wonderful world of ecology, evolution, and natural history. Within that theme, Aaron and I have picked topics that are unknown to the other. So we get to surprise each other every week. And this week, or this time around, I guess, our theme is keystone species.
Absolutely. You want to give a little brief description?
Yes. So if you're familiar with the world of ecology, you probably are well-versed on keystone species. But for those who don't know, a keystone species is a species within an ecosystem whose impact on the ecosystem is quite disproportionate to its population. So it is quite essential for the functioning and state of that ecosystem as we know it. So an organism like, you know, krill or sardines wouldn't necessarily be considered a keystone species, even though they're very important and are a huge source of food, because they're so numerous. There are so many of them. They wouldn't be considered a keystone species because their impact is not disproportionate to their population. Right? Mm-hmm.
And removing a keystone species or greatly reducing their population usually has drastic effects.
Correct. Correct.
To that extent, we probably discussed quite a few examples that are keystone species, but yes, we just didn't flat out say they were.
Yeah, like I know that a classic example are beavers, which I've discussed on this show. But I, again, like you said, I don't think I outright said that they were keystone species, but they definitely are. And in that piece, I think I outlined why they're keystone species without using that specific phrase.
Without actually saying it, yeah.
Right, right. So, with that in mind, should I kick things off here?
Go for it.
All right. So, a lot of times, if people have heard about keystone species, they think of a few very well-known examples, right? Wolves in Yellowstone being a classic example. Right. In the 1920s, the United States basically allowed for the complete eradication of wolves from the Yellowstone area, which had huge ecological impacts. Their main prey is elk. So elk populations exploded, which led to the decline in many tree species because the elk ate all the young trees. And the animals which depended on those trees also declined. So it was a huge ecological cascade which happened after the wolves were taken out. Of course, this eventually became something of a conservation success story because the wolves were reintroduced and those harmful ecological effects were undone to some extent. Another example of keystone species that people think of are sea otters in shallow water marine environments in the Pacific. You know, those otters were hunted to near extinction and this wreaked havoc on ecosystems because the otters were the main predators of sea urchins, which specialize in eating the base of kelp. Without the otters, the urchins thrived, and the kelp disappeared, which eliminated this vital habitat for many different fish, crustaceans, and other organisms. All of which is to say is that these typical examples often feature well-known vertebrates, and often very cute ones, too, that people can relate to. And this gives the impression that keystone species have to be larger predatory types of animals that keep prey animals in check, which is not always the case. That is not to say that the wolves or otters that I just discussed are not very important, but it's also worth discussing other organisms that have these kinds of outsized impacts on their ecosystems, but aren't necessarily predators or well-known animals or even particularly cute for that matter. So, with that in mind, I will discuss a far less adorable organism. What's more, it's an urchin. So, this time around, I'll be talking about long-spined sea urchins in the Caribbean.
Oh, you're turning on its head. Usually urchins are the bad guys.
Yes, this time they're the good guys, and I think I'll do a good job of explaining why. But the long-spined sea urchin, or Diadema antelarum, is a small, hard-shelled member of the echinoderm family, which also includes other organisms like starfish and brittle stars. Their bodies are only about 5 centimeters wide, but, as their name suggests, their spines can be 3 to 4 times that length, or even longer. these spines are very brittle and will break off very easily. So essentially, they're designed to pierce an enemy and then snap off, so the end of the spine becomes embedded. This wound then likely becomes infected from the bacteria and mucus that coats the spine. So it's a pretty nasty injury.
So it's good that they break off. Otherwise, you'd just be stuck there.
Yes.
It doesn't really help anyone at that point.
Right. They're designed to break off. So not very fun. Good defense mechanism overall. This species is also nocturnal, and they're very sensitive to light. So if a shadow actually passes over them, you know, like from a diver or a large fish, they will actually instinctively move their spines toward the shadow and try to hide. So they can sense disruptions in light, but we don't exactly know how. They also feed in groups. You know, they kind of move in these little packs. But how these groups are coordinated is still largely a mystery. We just know that you tend to find them in clusters. We don't know how or why, but it's kind of cool.
And if Surf's Up, the hit movie from 2008, taught me anything, if you step on one, you gotta pee on the wound. Don't try that. I don't think that's
We should go on record saying that you should definitely not do that.
I know people say it about jellyfish, and it's not true for jellyfish.
It's not true. Yes, not at all.
It's osmolarity, so sometimes vinegar can work. Maybe if you got really
the best salty thing. Urine. Yeah, the best thing to do is to use the salty water around you.
Yeah,
that's the best thing to do. Is to use that to rinse out all of the nematocysts that are still present. But anyway, I digress. It is also important to note that the long-spined sea urchin is within the genus Diadema, and they are the only member of this genus in the Caribbean. That's an important fact, and you'll understand why later. There are other species of urchin in the Caribbean, but none that are closely related to Diadema antelarum. Anyway, so in order for this to be a keystone species, there has to be some kind of outsize effect on their habitat, you know, these coral reef habitats in the Caribbean. So why are they so important? Well, that has to do with their diet. You see, the urchins eat microalgae, at least primarily. This is important because of the situation coral reefs continually find themselves. Corals are not very fast-growing organisms, and that's why coral die-offs are such a big deal. It can take decades or even centuries for corals to replenish themselves fully after being completely wiped out. So, as a result, because they grow so slowly, they're often outcompeted by other flora, algae being one of them, right? So, the urchins remove any algae growing on the reefs and keep the corals from being crowded out by the algae. This is incredibly important because the reefs are so diverse. Without the corals, a phenomenally productive ecosystem would basically cease to exist. And without the Diadema urchins, algae would suffocate the corals, because other urchin species don't quite have the same appetite for microalgae or don't rove around the same way that this specific species does. So, in other words, without the long-spined sea urchins, the corals get outcompeted and the reefs suffer as a result. So this seems like a situation you'd really want to avoid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is exactly what happened in the Caribbean in the 1980s, specifically from 1983 to 1984. Because in January of 1983, urchins began dying like crazy across the Caribbean. It started in the area around the Panama Canal and spread east from there, following along prevailing currents. Whatever was killing the urchins was incredibly fast. Within 2 weeks of biologists noticing sick urchins on a reef, nearly 100% of them would be dead. I'm just going to let that sink in for a second.
That's certainly a lot.
Yeah, very fast, incredibly high mortality rate. And this affliction spread around the Caribbean to various islands and reefs over the next couple of years, just wiping out urchins as it went.
Was it just these urchins or all urchins?
Just the specific species.
Oh, okay.
Yes. It seems to have been very specialized to the long-spined sea urchins. But these are some of the most effective algal herbivores, so it's a really important species and a huge development as a result.
It's an inside job by big algae.
Yeah, they paid someone off.
But just some kid with a pellet gun. Load up some rock salt or something.
Or just a whole bunch of kids with like little grabber arms, you know, going around just lifting urchins off reefs. But what's interesting to note here about this particular event is that some of the reefs outside of major currents were left largely unaffected. So that's why they think it was some kind of pathogen or bacteria or something. However, on the reefs that were impacted, you know, closer to these large currents, about 97% of the urchins died.
Oh, so you say they think it's a pathogen. They don't fully know what caused it?
They don't.
Oh, well, that's frightening.
They still have no idea what caused this. Or they don't have no idea, but they don't know for sure. They have ideas, but and hypotheses.
I mean, you can rule a lot of things out. If it's specific to that species, then it sounds like a pathogen. It wasn't like an elimination of all the urchins. But yeah, wow.
Right. And that's why they think it was... That's why the trajectory of this die-off is so relevant. Because it followed those currents, they think that it was some kind of bacteria or pathogen or parasite that was carried by the currents around the Caribbean. Whereas if it was something else like a water quality issue or, you know, some kind of pollutant, they would be able to trace that somewhere else in a different way. So that's why the path along those currents is so important to this story. But regardless of what caused it, the effects were massive. In the areas that were affected by the die-off, coral reefs suffered like crazy, and because they were overtaken by microalgae, and because the algae now had, you know, its primary herbivore, completely removed from the ecosystem. And what's more, the fact that other stressors like ocean acidification and overfishing started rearing their ugly heads only compounded the problems for the reefs. So, and like I said, there's no real satisfying resolution here because we don't know what caused it for sure. So, in the 40 years since the die-off of 1983, there have been some modest signs of recovery. However, the populations of urchins on those reefs are still only about 12% of what they were before that point. So we're still seeing major effects of this even today. This is somewhat unexpected because urchins produce thousands of eggs every month that spread planktonically to nearby areas. And so you'd think that they would, you know, replenish themselves pretty quickly, right? They produce a lot of gametes. Those gametes get fertilized, and those fertilized gametes can go any number of different places and repopulate these areas. But that hasn't really happened. So, because it's so unexpected, there have been a few different hypotheses that have been floated around about why the urchins haven't quite rebounded yet. And I'm going to take you through each of these hypotheses, and I'm interested to hear which one you think is most valid.
Okay.
So number one is that the urchins are still combating the affliction or disease or pathogen from 1983. And this has kept their populations low. This one seems personally pretty unlikely to me. For one thing, we probably would know what caused the die-off if that culprit was still around. And for another, surviving urchins likely would have developed some kind of resistance to that disease or pathogen or parasite. So eventually they would have seen some kind of recovery beyond what we see today. At least in my opinion. A second explanation is that there aren't many eggs actually being fertilized because populations are so low. This one makes more sense, right? because urchins have lower population densities, there's less potential for population growth. And when they just randomly release these gametes into the ocean, because there are few urchins, the probability that one actually gets fertilized is far lower. And then the probability that, you know, those remaining fertilized zygotes actually develop into adults is even lower from there. So they really are, in this hypothesis, are facing something of an uphill battle. However, as I mentioned before, the urchins do tend to group up. So this also seems unlikely, at least to me, to be wholly responsible for their lack of response or, you know, regeneration after the 1983 die-off. The third hypothesis states that larval urchins have trouble finding suitable habitat for them to grow into adults because of the proliferation of algae. Now, there is evidence to suggest that the larvae prefer unfouled substrates to cling to once their planktonic phase ends. So in other words, once they're done drifting around and they find somewhere to cling onto and grow into adults, they prefer an area that isn't covered in algae, either because they don't like those areas or because there are parasites which live among the algae which kill the young urchins.
And this is the algae that they eat?
Yes.
You know, it's essentially like saying, I had to leave the barbecue because there's too much food.
Well, so they're not fully developed adults at that point. So the way I kind of think about it is, if you think about oysters in the Chesapeake Bay, those oysters are looking for hard substrates that they can cling to when they're trying to end their planktonic phase, right? They're not necessarily looking for the same kinds of food. They're mostly just looking for something they can grab onto. And in my mind, at least, it's harder to grab onto the slippery algae than it is like a hard rock or coral or something of that nature. So that makes a bit more sense to me. There's this algae everywhere, not only because of the urchin die-off, but also because of overfishing, right? A lot of the fish species that would have kind of taken over from the urchins are being over-harvested in the Caribbean. So their populations are also really low. The thing here, though, is that the data doesn't entirely back this hypothesis up. Areas with healthy populations of herbivorous fish, like Panama, have seen relatively slow increases in urchin populations, while relatively large increases have been seen in areas like Puerto Rico and Jamaica, which have much heavier fishing pressures. So maybe it's not correlated to fish populations. There is some evidence to suggest that the presence of other urchin species increases the recruitment of the young long-spined urchins, but there's no significant trend correlation between the recruitment of young long-spined urchins and the presence of adult long-spined urchins, which is unexpected. Regardless, some research is focusing on creating artificial substrates to which the urchins can bind, not unlike the reef ball projects in the Chesapeake Bay that facilitate the oyster recovery.
So it's like little landing pads for them.
Pretty much.
As they transition from plankton to benthic-dwelling adults. Literally correct. Just a spot for them to land, touchdown.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's essentially just a runway, you know, without the air traffic control. But anyway, the last hypothesis is that feeding pressure from fish is keeping the populations low. This one has some evidence to support it. Areas that are unprotected from fishing do tend to have higher populations of urchins. However, examinations of stomach contents of fish after the die-off of 1983 to 1984 found that fish which previously fed on the urchins simply moved on to other forms of prey rather than focusing on the remaining urchins. So there could be something to this, right? As urchin populations have slightly recovered, fish might have started preying on them again a little bit more. But based on what we know about the stomach contents of the fish that have been found, there's not a whole lot of evidence to really support that.
Doesn't have to be fish. I know there are also starfish and snails that feed on urchins as well.
Sure, sure. But if the fish aren't feeding on the urchins, it seems unlikely that other benthic organisms are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's no real distinguishing. I don't really personally see any distinguishing characteristics between, you know, a fish not being able to prey on urchins because urchins are scarce, and a starfish somehow simultaneously being able to prey on the urchins even though they're scarce, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that if the fish managed to move on and prey on other things, that the starfish and snails would have done the same.
It would be more difficult for them to.
Right, right. So,
but I have no idea if there even are predatory starfish in this area.
Right. Very true. But anyway, which of these do you think? What are your thoughts on these different guesses?
Well, I like you said, the first one doesn't make a ton of sense to me because
sure.
You would think we would find it if it was still present in the population.
Right.
The idea of the second one, that was essentially, even though they're releasing a lot of eggs and sperm, they're just not meeting. Was that it? Like, like the eggs aren't getting fertilized? Because they're broadcast spawners, they just spew it out.
Right, right. So basically because their population densities are so low, the odds that an egg and a sperm meet and fertilize is far lower because there just aren't urchins near each other. Because so many of them died off.
So that form of reproduction is often suited for animals when there's really high populations of them, which there were for these urchins at a time. Whereas animals with low populations, so think like top predators or really large herbivores, they only have one kid at a time and they have to really invest a lot of parental care. So that kind of, you know, throw them all out and, you know, shoot them all and let God sort them out sort of thing. That doesn't work when you barely have anything to begin with. Right. And I know sometimes with populations, you get to a point where there's a threshold where you have to hit this number to get a stable population. And it varies for every species. Maybe they're just barely towing that line.
Right. It's, you know, it could be possible that once urchin populations reach a certain point that, this kind of spawning will really start working for them and that population growth will kick in and we'll start seeing more dramatic increases. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. The algae one, again, I like the idea of little landing pads for them, but if that is the case, there's too much algae for them.
Should we get like little lobsters out there with like glow sticks to like guide them in?
Now I was going to say like, just get some volunteers with Brillo pads, you know? Like, we'll clean it up a little bit. Where was this at again?
This is in the Caribbean.
It's in the Caribbean. Perfect. You give a bunch of volunteers like a weekend in a resort. All you got to do is start scrubbing some algae off. Clean a patch, and then the urchin's got a place to land.
You know, I think there would be a lot of people who would go for that, honestly.
A lot of people would go for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Could say like one day of work and then the next day is on us. You know, just relax. I go for it.
Sure. At an all-inclusive?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me where to sign up. But what do you think about the last couple of hypotheses?
That was with like the large predatory fish.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that could play a role, but I don't necessarily think it's the biggest one.
Okay. Okay. Personally,
to me, it sounds like if your populations are so low and you're just barely making it by, like there's only so much growth you can have.
Right. Right. Personally, I think that the third hypothesis with the substrate issues is probably the one that's closest to the truth. But in all likelihood, it's some combination of these four, at least in my mind. I don't think one of these is solely responsible for the populations remaining as low as they are. But whatever the cause may be, there is some reason for optimism here. Urchin populations are recovering, albeit slowly. There was actually a recent outbreak of a parasite in 2022. This is good news, I promise, which was identified very quickly. So scientists are more prepared to protect the urchins now than they were before. So it's possible that if something like this were to happen again, the scientists that are very closely monitoring these urchins would notice it, react, pull the urchins out, and figure out what's going on.
And the urchins that the parasite got, we just didn't really like them anyway. Those particular ones, we just weren't a fan.
Yeah, yeah.
Never returned Christmas cards, double barking.
So in any case, here's to hoping that the urchin populations continue increasing in the years to come and that coral reefs make a comeback as a result. Yeah. But that's my piece.
Yeah, really cool piece. You don't usually hear urchins as the good guys.
That's the thing, and that's why I wanted to do this piece. I was looking at different keystone species, and as I was alluding to in the intro, I read all about otters and wolves and things like that, and then I started getting into the really cool stuff, and I found the urchins. So I had to talk about them. But what have you got to talk about?
All right. So I'm going to discuss a keystone species that everyone knows and loves.
Okay.
Okay, we give you a hint. They're a elongated aquatic animal, which aids in their swimming. Very lovable. Is common knowledge that they feed on sea urchins, which in turn helps them play a crucial role in maintaining kelp forests. They're well adapted to cold ocean waters and exhibit excellent parental care. And they can be found in the National Aquarium. Want to take a guess?
So you're leading me towards sea otters, but it's not sea otters.
It is the adorable and beloved Atlantic wolffish.
Nice.
Yeah. So for my piece, I'll go over a bit of their biology, their role as a keystone species, and then kind of end with their current conservation status.
Okay.
So, first off, what is the Atlantic wolffish? Atlantic wolffish, scientific name, is Anacharis lupus, which roughly translates to climbing wolf.
Interesting.
At one time, it was thought that they could climb onto land or, like, over rocks. In reality, sometimes they just make their way in the tide pools. They don't really climb at all. They're not good at it. But the name stuck. And then the wolf part comes from their very sharp teeth.
Got it. Okay.
And these do go by many different names, including sea wolves, ocean catfish, stone biters, devilfish, wolf eels, Scotch halibut, and my personal favorite is just wolf.
Wolf?
Just wolf.
Okay.
Nothing else.
I'm looking up a picture of these guys, and wow, are they ugly.
Yeah.
They are hard on the eyes.
They have a charm to them.
Or lack thereof. Damn.
So they are a long blue-gray fish. They can reach an average size of about 3 feet, but can get over 5 feet long and 50 pounds, or 1.5 meters and 18 kilograms. They have a long dorsal fin that runs the length of their body, a blunt, kind of squishy-looking head, and several sharp, snaggled teeth. It does resemble an eel because of its body shape, but it is not an eel. Again, most fish that are called eels aren't actually eels. They're not in the eel family at all. Just like the go-to for any long fish.
Okay.
I did find a couple comments online that describe them as their face looks like a boxer's ear, which is a pretty good description if you just looked at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like a lumpy old man fish, but they're charming in their own way.
Yeah, it's like a... I wouldn't say that they look like a boxer's ear. I'd say that it definitely looks like their teeth look like they were messed up by a boxer. I'll say that.
Their whole head does.
But their teeth especially.
Yeah. Yeah, they got them snaggle jaws. So wolffish live in the Atlantic Ocean in cold waters. They prefer to live on the bottom and can be found depths between 60 to over 1,000 feet deep.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You can find them on the western side of the Atlantic, from Canada down to Massachusetts. And on the eastern side, you can find them from the Russian coast down to Britain and France.
Okay.
So, like I said, they're benthic-dwelling fish. And their eel-like bodies allow them to fit perfectly in all sorts of rocky nooks and crannies. So they don't tend to stray far from their homes. You get a lot of protection there.
Sure.
As they get older, they may undergo slight seasonal migrations, but this usually just involves them moving closer to the shoreline in colder months. So as it gets colder, they'll, you know, get a bit closer to the surface. They actually have antifreeze in their blood to help them cope with the cold temperatures.
Oh, that is cool.
So they tend to get, I wouldn't say a bad, they don't have a good reputation. People don't go flocking to see them at the aquarium. They are at the Baltimore Aquarium. I'm pretty sure I saw them, and I thought it was cool to see one, but they're kind of just lumpy. They don't have the same effect as the sea otters or the penguins, I'll say that much.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely not.
But they actually exhibit pretty great parental care, which you don't see too often for fish. So eggs are fertilized internally, and the parents guard over them. A lot of fish will kind of just release thousands of larvae at once and hope for the best. Like the urchins, you kind of just cast them out and, you know, hope one of them makes it. But in these guys, the males will actually guard the eggs for up to 4 months.
Oh, wow.
This is likely because they have a very slow development.
Sure.
So it's better to invest a lot into your offspring, especially if you're not pumping them out throughout the year in high quantities.
Right.
They pair up for the breeding season, and it is thought that they actually mate for life. But I really haven't found any definitive evidence of this, other than kind of just mass circulated little factoid sheets on them, you know?
Hmm. Okay.
But with any, or with most keystone species, usually the most important part is their diet. It's what they eat. Because, you know, what you eat is kind of what you do when you're an animal. You're just eating and breeding. And that's really it. That's the checklist.
Yeah. Your daily routine is pretty simple.
Like I mentioned earlier, wolffish have a ton of sharp, snaggled, and cone-shaped teeth and a very strong bite. So this allows them to feed on tough-shelled animals like crabs, snails, starfish, and sea urchins.
Hey.
And this is actually where my research took a turn, and I considered changing topics.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I'm picking a topic, the first thing I do is, you know, I pull up a Wikipedia page just to get all the basics down. And then from there, I'll transition to Google Scholar to get the specifics.
Sure.
Or sometimes I'll check the sources. And I was able to, you know, look at Wikipedia and then a couple like fact sheets from a couple universities, aquariums, stuff like that. And all of them talked about how the Atlantic wolffish is a keystone species because they act just like the sea otter. Right? Just the different ocean where they feed on these sea urchins and the sea urchins eat the kelp. So by having more of these, you'll help protect these kelp forests, which is a crucial habitat for countless different species.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just thought these are just weird, slimy sea otters. And instead of using their little paws and our rock, you know, it's all tucking into the little folds, all cute. Now they just crack it open with their jaws. A bit more horrifying to watch.
Yeah, very much the anti-hero.
So the idea of wolffish being a keystone species came from a paper, to my knowledge. The first time it was mentioned was in 1982, is when that paper was published. And I could not read it because it was behind the paywall. But the summary concluded that wolffish and lobsters as well play key roles in reducing sea urchin populations. And it said that the recent boom in sea urchin numbers was due to a decrease of both these predators.
Okay.
The way they conducted the study was actually by rearing the animals in tanks and examining what their prey preference was. So, you know, you give them urchins and then you expose them to other different preys for them to feed on.
Right.
And they combine that with observations like in the environment that there's more sea urchins, there's less wolffish and lobsters. They concluded that the wolffish and the lobsters were key to controlling the urchins.
Okay.
And like I mentioned, this was important because urchins are prolific kelp eaters. And yes, this is a crucial habitat. So we need these fish to eat the urchins to protect these kelp forests, which is just good for everyone across the board.
Right.
This idea just kind of seemed to be ingrained. It was almost like every source I found that mentioned it would cite it back to a paper, which would cite it to another paper and cited it back to this one. So it was like a game of telephone. In fact, some of the citations for larger sources, it was just like a large book of fish. And if you looked up where they're getting it from, it would be like a paragraph about the wolffish that basically just said Atlantic Ocean, strong bite, keystone species, which really is not a lot to go off of.
That's almost nothing to go off, yeah.
Yeah, and it was kind of just passed around like that.
Okay.
I actually read a paper that was published 8 years after this one in 1982, specifically on sea urchins in the Atlantic Ocean. And it just kind of debunked everything. It actually stated that wolffish weren't necessarily these vigorous urchin predators, and they were kind of just correlating increased urchins and decreased wolffish. They didn't have evidence it was actually the cause. Basically, both were just happening at the same time. It could be any number of things. And this was just passed around inside till it was accepted as fact.
Yeah, correlation does not imply causation.
So there's a following study in 1985 that found the decline in wolffish had nothing to do with the increase in urchins at all. And this one was kind of just pushed under the rug. And there's one researcher who originally published a paper that said urchins were 75% of the wolffish diet, and then later said they were back to square one in finding the link between predation, sea urchins, and kelp forests in the Atlantic Ocean. And this is like the whole idea of what I was doing kind of just shattered, of these wolffish being superb urchin predators.
So then why are you still talking about them?
Well, there's still interesting information I found on them. And like I said, it took a turn.
All right.
It comes about in the end.
All right. Well,
and I think it's nice to say like how things are not always what they appear to be. Ecology is more complicated.
Yeah. Consider me prepared for some screeching tires here.
Okay. So there are other animals that also feed on kelp, like rock crabs. And one paper published in 91 found that Atlantic wolffish were a known predator of rock crabs, but so are cods, halibut, lobsters. It's not just the wolffish.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Yeah.
And this is kind of the slump. And I thought, like, all right, so they don't eat sea urchins. I got to throw them out the window. And they're not actually a keystone species anymore. But the whole concept of the keystone species is kind of flexible.
Very.
There's no like mathematical way to say, this is keystone species. It's just animals that have a disproportionately large effect on their ecosystem. Like you said, krill, if you were to cut the krill in half, it would have an effect, but like the effect per krill is pretty minimal.
Right. Right. And honestly, the issue with the term keystone species is that after the initial paper, which defined keystone species, was released, the term started becoming very overused.
Do you know where the term, why it's called keystone exactly? Wasn't it something with starfish?
Yeah, so the original paper was by Payne in, I believe, 1960. And he essentially was studying these tide pools in the Pacific Northwest and was just removing certain organisms from the tide pools and found out that when he removed the starfish from the tide pools, that mussels would take over the tide pools. And almost nothing else could live there. He just determined this through careful experimentation about removing certain organisms and seeing what happened in these essentially isolated little mini ecosystems. And he found that the starfish were having a very outsized effect on the tide pools because they kept the mussels in check.
Mm-hmm.
And then he coined the term keystone species based on the keystone of an arch, which supports the whole thing, and released the paper, which has become a seminal paper in the world of ecology. And now we have the term keystone species, which every biology student hears about at one point or another.
Yeah, you're going to hear about it. That is biology 101.
Yep.
So, like I said, the whole concept of the keystone species is a bit flexible.
Sure, absolutely.
And usually a keystone species is a top predator because there's going to be fewer of them in any environment. Not always, but usually.
Often, yeah.
There's going to be few of them in environment, and just by eating everything, you keep a lot of populations in check. So with the starfish, they kind of promoted biodiversity because they kept the mussels from just overtaking everything in the tide pool. And when we look at what wolffish eat, I think this is somewhat similar, because I looked at some more recent studies on Atlantic wolffish, and the overall trend is they like hard-shelled prey animals. But they are not necessarily picky about it. So this includes crabs, lobsters, shrimp, hermit crabs, starfish, sea urchins, snails, clams, oysters, mussels, etc.
So, and if I remember correctly, you said that the lobsters also feed on the urchins, don't they?
That one study found that the lobsters did, but that one might be a little dicey because the whole bit about the wolffish doing it was kind of debunked. So I don't know if the lobster approach still holds water in that regard.
Right. Okay.
So I just started looking at different studies, a couple in the North Sea. One found that the Atlantic wolffish ate primarily decapods, which is like crabs and lobsters. And sea urchins made up a very low portion of the diet, which, again, it completely disagrees with that other study.
Sure.
Another one agreed with this, but it brought another element into play. So overall, they prefer to eat crabs, lobsters, and snails, but they actually have dietary shifts as they get older. So smaller wolffish will eat softer prey animals, like worms or small snails, and the adults would still focus on crabs and lobsters, but would incorporate more starfish and sea urchins. So I was like, okay, we're back to sea urchins again. And the more I read, it was just... they eat whatever they want. And it just varies by location. They're both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, which is two very different habitats.
Yeah, absolutely.
So studies show more and more food sources like sand dollars, redfin fish, younger wolffish. They were cannibals. And a couple of these just said decapods, which are, you know, crabs and lobsters. But one study found that they love to eat hermit crabs. That is their preference, which is... you know, kind of cool, because a whole point of a hermit crab is they carry these shells around to protect them, you know, from bigger fish.
Not from a wolffish, though.
No, they just crack the whole shell open. They do not care. That is their purpose. They're the shell crackers of the sea. Another study found that they actually like clams and oysters to be their primary food source. Actually, quite a few found that they're really good at foraging for bivalves.
So I'm just picturing the wolffish. So I'm picturing these hermit crabs, you know, getting settled into their new little homes after they, you know, upgrade, so to speak. They're feeling all secure in their nice hard-shelled exterior. And then the wolffish just busted down like the Kool-Aid man. You know,
oh yeah,
and just devours them whole.
Yeah, that could be a experience for many a hermit crabs out there.
All right, I'm gonna start calling these guys the Kool-Aid fish.
That's a good name for them. I just called them the shell crackers of the sea, or the mutant nutcrackers, because that's what they have going for, and they got that strong bite. They could hunt down small fish, but these jaws allow them to access food resources that most other predatory fish can't.
Yeah, so why bother?
And so the diets will vary by season, location. they will switch to harder prey items as they get older because they are able to.
Right.
And yeah, so sea urchins and starfish, even though they eat them, they don't eat them all the time simply because these are really low in nutrition. There's not, you can't get a ton out of a sea urchin.
Yeah.
Mostly just spikes and shells. It's
sure.
You know, no one really goes out of their way to eat a sea urchin. So at first I thought it was super simple. Sea urchins eat kelp. Wolffish eat sea urchins. More wolffish, more kelp. And I learned that it's a lot more complicated than that. But I still consider these a keystone species because they are like running the benthic environments. Basically, all these animals have evolved shells to protect them, whether that's crabs, you know, they just have a hard exoskeleton, hermit crabs carrying it around, or a snail, oyster. And these are the guys that do not care. They will bypass any form of security.
Okay.
So, like I said, keystone species has a disproportionately large effect relative to their abundance. And these fish are not terribly abundant, and they can completely run. They can keep. Because they can forage on such a wide variety of these hard-shelled organisms, they can completely shift the balance of the ecosystem. So I agree with the theory that they are a keystone species, but time has shown that it's not really just they eat this one thing and that's good.
Gotcha. See, this is why the bit about the term keystone species being very flexible is important to mention, because I would actually disagree with you based on what you said. Because to me, it sounds like the wolffish are only having an outsized impact upon their potential prey. And any other organisms that they do not directly prey on are not necessarily affected by their ability to crack open shells. So these aren't ecosystem-wide effects that you're talking about. These are effects that are happening, that are occurring just solely based on their potential prey within this ecosystem, not the ecosystem as a whole. Like is the case with other well-known keystone species.
For most keystone species, like I said, they're large predators at the top of the food chain. So a great example is Maryland. Maryland now is completely different from Maryland, you know, 300 years ago, obviously, urbanization sure. aside. We don't have any top predators in Maryland anymore. We don't have wolves and we don't have mountain lions.
Sure.
So the wolffish, if they are the top predator in these benthic environments, you take them away, all these animals no longer have a predator anymore. There is no way that that ecosystem cannot be changed.
Okay,
because again, they can crack the hardest shells of all these organisms.
That's not the argument you were making, though. You weren't making the argument for them being a keystone species because of their position as an apex predator. You were making the argument for their classification as a keystone species based on their ability to crack open the shells of their prey and the adaptations which those prey have then developed to counter that. They're related, but they're not the same argument, at least in my mind.
Okay. Well, in these benthic communities, you have a lot of hard-shelled animals, and these are the top predators. And in a lot of cases, they might be the only predators for especially these really large, like bivalves.
Okay.
And when you take them away, there's no way that ecosystem could not be changed.
Okay. So that's a different argument, and I'm with you on that one. Then yes, you could argue that they're keystone species based on that. Yes.
Again, the whole concept of keystone species is there's no checklist. There's no, you can't like put into a calculator and say that it is or isn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the sad bit about the wolffish is there's really not much known about them. So even though there's all these studies, they're mainly just bycatch. That is, I imagine, where a lot of it comes from. They're common bycatch. Some people fish for them intentionally. Apparently, they're popular fish and chips in some recipes. But the IUCN does not even have an estimate for their population. even though a lot of countries actually consider them to be a species of interest or endangered.
That's how you know
on a global level.
That's how you know it's a true benthic organism, when you just don't know how many of them there are.
Mm-hmm. So, like I said, this one had some roadblocks, and it wasn't necessarily an easy research, but I wanted to keep going with it just to show that everything is kind of complicated with ecology, and just because something is passed around as true doesn't mean necessarily is. Like, I really had to dig deep for this one.
I love how, like, we do this podcast about ecology and explaining certain concepts on this podcast and telling certain stories. And a lot of times we come to the same conclusion that ecology is really complicated and we don't really understand that much.
Yeah, it comes around often. Maybe we're not the best ones to explain it.
Yeah.
But we have fun with it, and that's important.
We do. That's really the key here, is that you have fun doing it, because in the end, how much do we really know?
Mm-hmm. So I guess my main takeaway is Atlantic wolffish, they're cool. They're beyond cool looking. They have some really cool adaptations. And yeah, we just don't have enough information on them, but we know they're on their way out. So now's the time to start studying them. I actually read through someone's master's thesis, and it was just 60 pages. And they were trying to do stable isotope analysis on these wolffish, and they were only able to get one. And that was, I mean, they made it work. They stretch it out, but you can't just catch these. They're caught as bycatch, but they live in these rocky caves. So she had to go scuba diving to get them.
Oh.
Like the waters off of Canada.
Oh, yeah, Lord.
Somewhere up in Canada. Yeah, they had to go diving to get them. And in the end, only came out with one. But still, it's like this very intensive research to just get one fish.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. All right. Yeah, I can honestly say that they were legitimately cool-looking fish.
They're a cool-looking fish. That could be the one takeaway you get from this.
Yeah.
Aaron was just struggling. Fighting for his life, trying to piece this together. Yeah, I committed to the bit, and it's like, it was a couple days before we were about to record, and I was like, there's got to be more.
Yeah. Yeah, I will admit I got lucky finding the urchins, but yeah, the trouble is there really isn't any comprehensive list of keystone species. Like, people talk about different species as examples and propose others as potential keystone species, but there really isn't any comprehensive list or even definition that can be generally applied to this concept.
Well, if you find the list, it's going to be wolf, otter, beaver,
yeah,
elephant,
yeah,
that's it,
right? So it's a term with a certain amount of subjectivity, which I think makes it more interesting to discuss overall.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really cool though.
Yeah, at the very least I did a little myth busting, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. All right. I'm assuming your piece is done?
Yep. Did you have any ideas for the next one?
I do not, as of the current moment.
So I had a idea, and I actually have a good one for this one.
Okay, go ahead.
It would be like individual research animals. Like famous research animals.
Like
there's
famous,
actually quite a few.
Like species or individual animals?
Not individuals. So like there's a big thing a while ago where there is this one mountain lion. I don't remember its name. It had like a number. And it was very popular on Twitter because it had a tracking tag on it. And they're able to write like a whole paper on this mountain lion. And it died. And there's like people upset about it.
Okay. Yeah. So for example, could I choose to talk about like mudang or something like that?
I wouldn't consider that a research animal.
But he's just so cute.
He is so cute. He was the solution to a crossword puzzle, and like I couldn't remember his I couldn't remember the name, but I had like some of the letters, so I'm like, I think it's Whoop Gang. It was not Whoop Gang.
No. No. Clearly not. Alright, so okay, I can make that work.
Okay, I have an actual good one for this.
Alright, with that decided, do you want to take us out?
Yep. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a like or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on Twitter or at theprimordialsoupot@gmail.com.
Alright, and until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.